Thus have I heard, the Buddha said, whatever should be done by a compassionate teacher who out of compassion seeks the welfare of his disciples, that I have done for you. These are the roots of trees. These are empty huts. Meditate, practitioners. Do not be negligent, or else you will regret it later. This is our instruction to you. So the Buddha here is urging us to go on retreat, to find solitude, whether that's in an urban center in the middle of a lot of traffic or out in the forest. And you may have heard that quote before, but the context is from a, did I write down the name of the sutta? No, I did not. It's from Anguttara Nikaya 770. The context is that he's talking about in long, long, long time ago, there was a teacher named Araka. And Araka was teaching hundreds of his followers, and this was his teaching. Short is the life of human beings, limited and brief. It is full of suffering, full of tribulation. This one should understand. One should do good and live a pure life. For none who is born can escape death. And he uses this fantastic series of similes to talk about how brief and fleeting human life is. He talks about dewdrops on the tip of a blade of grass at sunrise, water bubble that's sitting on the surface of the water in the middle of a rainstorm, a line drawn in water with a stick, a mountain stream rushing on, a lump of spittle, he was so earthy, I just love that. A piece of meat thrown into an iron pan that's been heating up all day, won't last long. And a cow walking to slaughter, step by step, each step closer to death. So those of you that read the title of this talk in the e-news, I never managed to get a blurb together. This is called What I Learned on Retreat. First thing I learned is never again to commit to what I learned on retreat. As a topic for a talk. That's quite a bad setup. Luckily, I only thought about it two or three times on the retreat. It doesn't bother me too much. And so the retreat that we're talking about is the second retreat in the series of three that was offered to the students in Steve Armstrong's Touching the Earth program. So Michael Patty and Jerry Simpkins and I were on this retreat. And Steve Armstrong, as many of you know, is in the midst of this journey toward death. He's had a brain tumor removed. Some of the cancer is still in the brain. His speech has been affected to some extent. And there was a retreat in Canada about 3 weeks ago for this same program. They got so many applicants that they set up a separate program in Canada with 24 people that were going on the retreat. And he was not able to attend. He just went up to it physically to make the journey to the mainland because he's living in Maui. He's back on the land at Ho'omalama, their sanctuary on Maui. So we felt quite fortunate that he was even there physically. And what he ended up doing is that he had some recorded talks that he played, but he was in the hall. He did all of the interviews that he had planned on doing, gave the instruction, And in the Q&A, I mean, you wouldn't have even known that there was anything going on. And it was really amazing. He was just right there with every question and not just, you know, answering it literally, but seeing behind the words as he always does. So it was amazing. And then to see Steve and Kamala up front teaching together again was, I had been on retreat with both of them in quite a few years because they were teaching separately for a number of years. So that was very moving. The other reason that was fantastic was that this retreat that they offered was a metta retreat. And specifically, it was using metta to develop concentration. So metta is generally practiced formally on retreat in two different ways. One is to incline the mind toward kindness, toward goodwill, and then the other is to develop concentration as a concentration practice. And we were all a little bit unsure of how this was going to go. No one there had ever done a retreat before where metta was used as the object of a concentration retreat. And it was really an amazing experience, truly, truly amazing. So I thought at this point I would give my two fellow yogis, if they would like, a chance to say whatever they'd like to say about the retreat or about how it felt to have Stephen Kamala there, or just kind of how it landed for you. They're both saying you can go first.
Yeah.
And I'd like you to use the mic so that the recording won't pick up your voice. Fred's just right on top of it here.
So even just now with Rich's comments about the retreat, I learned something. I learned something more. So, and my guess is that everybody that, all the attendees, it was 34 of us or so there, anyway, yogis there on retreat, almost all of us had, there was, well, let me say, there was a lot of comments at the very beginning about, yeah, metta. Yeah, we do metta during our Theravada practice and our wisdom practices and all of that, and but never really got into it. So, you know, Stephen Kamala just said, okay, you're going to do metta. and you know, one of the first instructions was go out and say the phrases for one category of person continuously for a day. Just repetitive, 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 and I was like, oh my God, how boring is this going to be? I was disappointed. And at the end of the day, it was like, I loved it. It was a concentration practice. So I didn't, the retreat just kind of, the practices and the explanations that Kamala and Steve were able to give us were like, just open the door to huge more areas of practice and focus and what more we can do. And I think I would just encourage that you get a chance to do a full metta retreat. It's definitely worthwhile doing. Yeah, having Steve there was something. The picture of him here. And Kamala is like the metta queen. She's a tremendous metta teacher. And if I got it right, she began her practice doing metta years and years ago. So,
so this whole program is a very kind of much fuller fleshing out of what it takes to develop yourself to move forward in this tradition. And so I really enjoyed that. There's been effort in expanding just momentary awareness, kind of using what they call occasionese method, but it's more on a generalized awareness method. There's a strong emphasis that you don't have to be looking for any objects, right? All the objects that you need to awaken are already present, you just have to recognize that they're there. So that's a big, there's no golden ticket objects that you have to kind of move around, right? Trying harder. And then you get to this first time in my experience in this whole tradition of seriously discussing the role of concentration, which Stephen and Kamala had never done this together before. So it was quite nice. And it's really clear that they were, this is how Upandita, who ended up being both of their teachers, had taught them concentration. They invited him to do metta. So Stephen told us the story about how they had to do metta for, he had to do metta for more than a year, I think he said about a year and a half. And Kamala did metta straight for 2 months to the same person every single moment, and she couldn't understand it. So this was really very nice, and then it was really nice to see the students lighting up the fact of the benefit of concentration. So the end whole story about me is I've sort of been a samadhi junkie now for about 5 years because I just see how well it makes my mind ready for other types of practice. And so I'd actually developed stability of mind for another practice. But so I was kind of made it more difficult for me on this retreat because I was doing both metta and this other thing I'd done. And I actually got pretty tired by the end. I think partly because Kamala really honed in on the fact, you know, we say these metta phrases to other people, but you're really working on yourself. And so you're kind of rewiring yourself. And so I must have a lot of stuff in there that needs rewiring. Because it was a lot of work. She also, you know, part of this course, they give you guided meditations for the month. And one that she gave us on compassion was, so like some typical compassion phrases, I see your suffering, I care about your suffering, maybe you say your suffering went away, but she also puts in this phrase, and may I open to your suffering. And I go, whoa, this is not something I want. So I recognize this is part of my own personalities for myself. I don't even open to my own big issues. So just to see everyone opening up about the benefits of the stability of mind, I've been, before we do, I was trying to remember this quote from the Buddha, and I can't really, still haven't been able to find it in the last few days, but it's basically that, you know, the Buddha didn't have the benefit of a Buddha, so he went through all the traditional practices, including all the absorption practices or concentration practices that were in India at the time. And apparently the Buddha has this legend that he invented even a new eighth absorption state. But still, so the great things about absorption is you temporarily get rid of all the defilements, okay? The bad thing about it is you don't have the defilements or the torments, whatever you want to call them, come back as soon as you stop doing this practice. So the Buddha thought that's why he had to learn to do new stuff. You were quite original on his part. But it was so nice to see all the students reporting sort of daily of, oh, the great benefits of all this concentration and the stability of mind. So the Buddha has this quote that I'm going to try and remember, but basically he makes this analogy to smelting gold, is that right? Where when you smelt gold, you kind of burn off all the impurities, and what's left is a mind that's extremely malleable and fit for work. Well, you set it to do a task, and it will do it. And so I think it was very clear to people who went on this retreat that, oh, wow, my Vipassana practice would really take off if I really became quite good at this concentration practice. So that's what I got out of that. I do feel a little bit like a black sheep because I've actually been following the Satipatthana Sutta primarily as my primary means of practice, but I've been following this other thing which is very similar called the Anapanasati Sutta, which is based on first three quarters of it are based on absorption, for the last quarter of it is based on Vipassana practice. So for me, this has been a really natural way for me to move my practice forward in a really step-by-step way. So in some ways, this whole course has been really great, I felt, because I think Steve is making a last real effort as a teacher to kind of show us all these aspects what you need for development if you want to get where you're going, including working on paramis, these, maybe you can say more about paramis, but So it's kind of like a complete washing. And it came together in this really unique way for this retreat, right? And these, what's really nice is there were 41 yogis on this retreat. I did a little bit of work in the kitchen. I can see the chalkboard. 41 yogis, four teachers, five staff, no, two teachers, four staff. You can see all the people who are delineated on here for food preparation. And we had met all these people in January. They had kind of cycled through into our interview group. So I would highly recommend this. If you are interested in concentration practice, there are three extremely good sets of teachers in the Bay Area. I don't know if they're as unusual. They all sort of follow a slightly different Buddhist tradition by this guy in Burma called Hao Ok. But they've written most of the original, the new 10 generation books on absorption practice. So one is this woman, Shaila Catherines in Sampe. She's written this new translation of the Sukha Magga, basically. Because the teacher asked her. There's Tina Rasmussen and Stephen Schneider, who wrote the first manual of absorption practice. And then there was this guy that I spent a lot of time with, Temple Smith. He worked in the East Bay. He spent 9 months or as a monk, or 8 months as a monk with Upandita, and then he went off to see Pao Ok. And he was so into the Upandita method, when he got to Pao Ok's monastery, he said, "What's wrong with all these people? They're kind of relaxed, they're kind of enjoying themselves. I'm going to have to show them why you need to practice." And he was so indoctrinated with only this one rigid, aiming, sustaining way of going. And it completely transformed his understanding of how you might practice. So, I said, would they be safe? Yeah, so it's a great retreat. This is a great program. I don't know if they'll be able to offer it again, but they've been taping everything, so there probably will be the remnants of pieces of this course available online for quite some time, and I would highly recommend it, especially if they can find people to sponsor you, because there's the other important aspect. There's like three online video conference calls a month with the teachers, and then there's one with our local group every month. So like every week there's basically an online Zoom session you can get into and actually develop Sangha that way. So it's really good.
So if I had known what I was talking about when I gave this title to Savitri, I would have said what I felt on the retreat. It wasn't a learning experience at all. It was a deep exploration of the heart. And that sort of was catalyzed by having Steve and Connell there, you know, just their presence and their deep practice. As Jerry said, this practice very quickly, well, not in my case, it's faster learner than me, it took me 4 days. But over 4 days, the phrases gradually went from this rote repetition all day long to actually feeling the metta, actually feeling it. And so some of you that have done formal metta practice here may recall that the way we teach it here is that you bring up an image of a person. The one piece, so there are four foundations of metta, just like Satipatthana has the four foundations of mindfulness, there are four foundations of metta. The first one is bringing up the image of the person, and then these other two that we've already talked about are the third and fourth, saying the phrases and connecting with the feeling of metta. The second one, which we don't often do here, which is really wonderful practice, and I've done it since the retreat with non-meditators, and they loved it and really responded to it, is remembering the good. So the proximate cause for metta is remembering the good. And so starting with yourself, before you start doing metta to yourself, remember a good action that you've done, remember the can't think of a good action that you've done, think of some good quality, some positive quality that you have that you're able to bring into the world. And then, as you know, the metta progresses from oneself to the benefactor, to a good friend or family member, to a neutral person, and then to a person that you're having difficulty with. We didn't get to that until the second to last day of the retreat. And that remembering the good is particularly helpful. I found it particularly helpful for the person that I was having difficulty with. Because they really cautioned us, when you're using metta as a concentration practice, you really shouldn't be taking on super, super challenging people. Because, I mean, again, there are the two purposes for the metta. One is inclining the mind toward the wholesome, but then the other one is to actually develop concentration. So if you take someone that's too disturbing, it'll just disturb the mind again. I mean, you'd already been meditating over a week at that point, so you don't want to be bringing in, you know, some figure that, you know, is just going to rile your mind up. Because that, I mean, it really can just, as Michael said, that concentration can just go away like that if you're not careful. So remembering the good, I found it very useful. I just took a person that I generally really like, but had one particular incident that didn't work for me for whatever reason. And so remembering the good for that person was very easy, and so that really brought the metta out quite easily, even though we had this one conflict over a single issue. So it's good to remember all of those. I think the remembering the good piece, which I have very seldom heard in any other context, is going to help my continuing practice of metta. I found that really a helpful thing. So the other thing that we talked about was metta as a practice for samadhi. And Steve is an Abhidhamma scholar, so he talked about the five jhanic factors that are in the Abhidhamma. So the first one is connecting the attention with an object. The second one is sustaining it on the object. And the way they explain that is, if you just take your hand and just touch the back of your hand lightly with a finger. Just touch it. You know, you don't really get the flavor of the texture of that hand when you do that. There's some sensation there. You don't really get the full range of texture, the complexity of that experience. Now just take the finger and rub it around the back of the hand. You start to get a feeling for the texture that's there. A much more nuanced and complex experience. So it's the same with the mind. When the mind just touches something and then moves away, it doesn't fully experience, doesn't have a chance to fully experience the unique flavor of that experience, which is the samadhi, that each experience has its own unique flavor. So irritation has its own unique flavor, joy has its own unique flavor, anger has its own unique flavor. Every experience we have has its own unique flavor. Just touching it lightly isn't going to get you to learn the unique flavor of each thing. But the rubbing, Pandita called this second factor rubbing, it's usually traditionally called sustaining. So you've got to connect and sustain. So you're paying attention, you connect with the object, and then you sustain the attention. For example, on a breath, you say, you know, try to notice the in-breath at the very beginning. So you're in the pause at the bottom of the out-breath. And then notice the very beginning of that in-breath, and then sustain the attention on that in-breath for the entire length of the breath. That's sustain. That's the equivalent of the rubbing. It's actually just keeping the mind there, not having it flitting away all the time that we tend to do. The third jhanic factor is actually joy. It's that piti, the same one that's in the seven factors of enlightenment. The third one, on the energizing side, piti. So it's sometimes it's called rapture, but it's an energetic joy. I've seen it happen in interview groups, not on this retreat, but on other retreats, where, you know, you'll have a group in on a retreat, and they'll all just start giggling and stuff like that. And after a few days in the middle of the retreat. That's actually PT, that's joy. That's falling over there. And then the next one is sukha, which is happiness. And the way that the difference between joy and happiness have been explained to me is that joy is you're crawling through the desert and you're crawling for weeks, you don't know if you're going to make it or not, and you see the oasis. So joy comes up. Happiness is actually drinking the water. So that's the difference. It's one of them is it's sort of like this energetic thing, but what's there? There's really nothing there, right? It's just this fleeting, bubbly experience, and then, you know, it's gone. Happiness, sukha, is much quieter, and Steve translates it as happy comfort of mind and body. So it's both the mind is infused with this happiness, and the body is so restful, tranquil. You know, the seven factors of enlightenment, you jump up to the calming factors. You know, tranquility is that next one, right? After PT comes tranquility. So, you know, the body is just sort of steeped in this restful ease, but the mind is quite active. The mind is quite awake and active. And at this point, you know, later in the retreat, I was needing a lot less sleep than I normally would because of the smooth, easy, effortless energy that sort of comes when you do this sort of practice. And then the fifth factor is single-pointedness, ekagata. And it's the ability to kind of narrow the range of things that the mind is jumping around to a single object. So that's why they were recommending that we not try to do all four phrases at the first couple days. We spent the first day just doing Vipassana. And the second day we did all four phrases. And then in formal practice, then they had us in the walking around. As Jerry said, just do one person. And I was still using all four phrases, but I was just doing it for one person. So I kept doing metta for the entire rest of the 9 days on that one person, but by the fourth day, I was saying one word. And as the momentum develops, the mind does not need as many reminders to stay present, to stay connected with the experience. So rather than saying, stay protected, peaceful and happy, healthy and strong, ease of well-being, peaceful and happy, healthy and strong, stay protected, you know, going through them all like that. First of all, after half a day, you start to remember them, which helps effortlessly, you start to remember them. But then I just took that last one, ease, and ease. 2 days, that was my phrase, ease, just ease. And then you say ease, or I would say ease, and then the mind would just stay with that before it needed another reminder for 10, 15, 20 seconds, and then ease. And then I was doing that both in the city and walking. And as all three of us have mentioned, at some point in the retreat, the actual feeling of metta starts to come up. That formerly wrote practice all of a sudden is, you know, many people in the go-around at the end were just talking about their hearts literally, you know, sort of bursting open. I didn't experience that so much as just kind of an overall warm sort of feeling. And then, you know, the purpose of this, of inclining the mind toward the good, is ultimately to make that the default setting of the mind. That when someone, you know, cuts us off in traffic, you know, rather than saying bad words or giving bad gestures or something like that, we actually, our first inclination is, oh, this person is suffering, or they wouldn't be acting like this. You know, this person like me just wants to be happy, but this is their, whatever they're doing here is their probably misguided attempt to try to be happy. And that eventually becomes, depending on your outlook, either decades or lifetimes, right? Eventually becomes the default setting of the mind. I mean, that's just where the mind goes. So in this retreat, the purpose was to get a very slight flavor of that. So just one tiny example, silly, trivial example. So I like to eat my breakfast outside. It's really cool, and coming from Sacramento, so I had some cool weather. And so I was drinking my tea, I don't know, fourth, fifth day in the retreat, and I went to put the tea up to my lips, and a mosquito started flying toward it. And rather than my usual reaction about mosquitoes, which I don't swat them anymore, but, you know, I just get away, or don't bother me, or what if it's carrying Zika, or, you know. All of those thoughts that we have, my first thought, that I was conscious of anyway, was, oh, be careful, this is hot, this cup is hot, watch out, or, you know, don't land in the tea, you'll drown or something. And it sort of like surprised me. Wow, you know, I think something's happening here. So that's the purpose. In the short term, the five jhanic factors, at least according to the Abhidhamma, Lee Brazington is another Bay Area scholar, he doesn't buy this because he bases everything just on the suttas. He doesn't look at the Abhidhamma or any of the later texts. But I think one reason they put all these five, Lee says that single pointedness isn't anywhere in the suttas with these, I mean it is, but not with these other four. But the reason they're put this way is that they are direct counters to the five hindrances. Okay? So connecting is, you might need to help me here, connecting is the antidote to sloth and torpor, right? Because that connecting activity is kind of the energetic one. It's when you actually touch into the thing and the mind is sort of awake. And, you know, I'm sure while we're connecting, there's other mental processes going on, like perception, right? And that sort of thing. So that wakes up the mind. That's the remedy for sloth and torpor. Sustaining is for restlessness. Yeah? So the sustaining, because of the ease in it, and the fact that it's just sort of continues, is the kind of starts to calm the mind, and is the antidote to restlessness. Joy for aversion or desire? Wanting, yeah. Joy and happiness are for, and I should have got my notes together better on this one. But joy and happiness are for desire and aversion, and then we've got the doubt, which I think is the single pointedness, is the pretty sure I'll need to double check these, but pretty sure single pointedness is doubt, because you're recognizing the nature of whatever it is that you're looking at. There's no doubt that that's what it is. Yeah. Right. Oh, this is brilliant. I copied a section of a sutta that explains which of the five hindrances each of the factors overcomes. Why didn't I think of that before? On returning from almsgathering, well, here's another urging to a retreat. Come, you monk, or practitioner, choose a remote lodging in a forest, at the root of a tree, on a mountain slope, in a glen, a hill cave, a cemetery, a woodland grove, in the open, or on a heap of straw. So there's a number of options for you. On returning from almsgathering after the meal, the monk sits down cross-legged, holding the back erect, having made mindfulness rise up in front of him. He, getting rid of covetousness for the world, dwells with a mind devoid of covetousness. He cleanses the mind of covetousness. Getting rid of the taint of ill will, he dwells benevolent in mind, compassionate and merciful toward all creatures and beings. He cleanses the mind of ill will. Getting rid of sloth and torpor, he dwells without sloth or torpor, perceiving the light. That's a practice that you can do to kind of wake up the mind and get away from drowsiness and dullness, is picturing light, or actually physically open your eyes and looking at the daylight or at night or looking at the light. Perceiving the light, mindful and clearly conscious, he cleanses the mind of sloth and torpor. Getting rid of restlessness and worry, he dwells calmly, the mind inward tranquil, he cleanses the mind of restlessness and worry. Getting rid of doubt, he dwells doubt crossed. I'm not quite sure what that means. I didn't have a chance to find another translation. Unperplexed as to the states that are skilled, he cleanses his mind of doubt. So that's from the Ganaka Moggallana Sutta, which is Majjhima Nikaya 107. The last thing I was going to mention in terms of what I felt on retreat was the power of Sangha. So as Michael mentioned, you know, often when you go on retreat, you show up, there's all these people there, and somehow this magic happens that your eyes are closed, you never talk to anybody, and by the end, they're your best friends in the world. Because they've created this safe container. And how many other places do we have where you feel completely safe? You know, nobody's hitting on you, nobody's telling you lies, you don't have to worry about anybody taking your stuff. I have to worry a lot about me leaving my stuff around and, you know, retreating it 3 days later, but don't have to worry about anybody else taking it. Just all of the safe container is created, and so you feel quite grateful to the people around you. And part of that, was pointed out on this retreat, part of the power of the Sangha in a retreat is the shared intention. Everyone is there not to get something, not to be anyone, not to impress anyone. You know, your eyes are closed, who cares? Not even making eye contact, you know? Everyone's there to do the practice. And I particularly felt that on this practice. At one point I was out walking, and there's a brick walking patio, and then there's a big wide brick gravel driveway. And at that point, quite a number of us were out sort of walking around, and it looked like this random movement of all these bodies around this square, and I realized everyone in my view is sending goodwill. Mm-hmm. Everyone there is sending goodwill. And could you imagine the world if there were a few billion more people doing that? You know, but just to know that just felt so safe. You know, that everyone in view is at least doing their best, you know, maybe not in that instant, but in general, doing their best to be sending goodwill for this entire week. So, but these people are also folks that we want on retreat with in January, folks hope to be going on retreat in October. None of us know that we'll be there, or that anybody else will be there, but hoping to be on our final retreat for this program in October. And then, you know, as Michael said, having interview groups with this time with a different group of people, and then sharing the Zoom calls with these people, and that's always a different group of who actually shows up and that sort of thing. So really kind of getting to know the people on a different level than just, oh, it was really nice sitting with you, you know, that sort of thing. That was really great. So I have a question for you. How many of you have been on retreat in the last year? Would you be willing to share maybe one or two things that you, often at the end of the retreat, they'll say, well, what are you taking away with you? And then it's actually whether you took away or not. Is anybody willing to share maybe what something that has stayed with you?
Well, I was in retreat in New Thailand on a month or so ago. And you're wondering, when retreats in Thailand.
Use a mic.
I mean, for your input.
Thank you.
Yeah, I was in a retreat in Thailand, Chiang Mai. And the first day or so, what I noticed was many ants in my room, very dirty, no hot water, and plugged up drains. And you know, after I noticed all this stuff, I was, you know, I'm not going to concentrate and get all huffy on the amenities here at this retreat. Number one, they're free, so how can I complain? But that's what I noticed at first, is I just kind of started looking at the negatives. And it was a 21-day retreat, which is, that was pretty long. What I noticed with you guys is that you went there and you knew people, and you sort of were able to bond. This retreat, people came and went, and when I left, I was sort of like, you know, just in the big city all of a sudden. So the transition was kind of rough, and I kind of lost my the retreat and a certain you get up in the morning, you dhamma talk, you meditate all day, all night, you do chanting, and the energy is at a certain level, then you just sort of thrown to the wolves, after 21 days, and that was kind of rough. So I like the idea that you go with people that you know and are able to kind of commune about it. It was an interesting retreat, way up in I think it's one of the highest temples in Thailand. It was a different technique I learned. I'm kind of just like want to stay with one technique. Too many techniques can kind of get confusing. Like, should I do this? Or even in one sit, I'll try my breath for a few minutes and then move on to this. So it's a whole other deal that I have to deal with. And what I noticed is these different retreats that you go to. They're always don't blend techniques. You do our technique and that's it. And I guess there's a reason for it, but I think I just really need to concentrate on sticking with one. And it's good to be back here in America.
I went to Spirit Rock about a month ago for a week-long silent meditation retreat, and it was my first retreat that was that long, and I did not know anyone else who was there, but people were not coming or going either. We were all part of the same Sangha. The retreat was partially metta and partially just kind of traditional teachings of Vipassana, and it was a very rich experience for me. I felt very close to my fellow retreatants in the same way that Rich was talking about. Had no contact with these folks. But the teacher did a really nice job at the end of the retreat, kind of finding a way for us to meet one another. And it wasn't a long time, but it was a breaking of the noble silence that invited contact in a very conscious, gentle way, and I was able to take that forward into my life, the rest of my life, as it were. And the sharing of that space and the sacredness of that space with people who were very different than I was and who all are very much like me was another reminder of how much we share, regardless of our differences, how much we care about the same kinds of things, and it was deeply heartfelt for me.
I had never retreat like I did this last weekend. It was also at Spirit Rock. It was a 3-day non-residential retreat. And it was on dependent origination. And this is a subject that there has been some aversion and some although when Tony Bernhard came, it was the first time really for me that it was quite wonderful how he brought that. But spending 3 solid days with this really vast, but also it's so central to the Buddhist all of the teachings. They're really all connected there. Because of the way in which each level can lead to the next, and to be able to work with that by having more time was really precious. And it was also by Temple Smith Michael, and I'll talk to you about him because he's quite a remarkable teacher. And so interesting when you take a subject and you want to really work with it and penetrate it. You only have 3 days, a very different experience, but clearly it changes your life. I find retreats, they change your life in a positive way always.
We have time for one more. Anybody wants to share? And then one behind you, Mary.
Hi. It's been actually been a little bit longer than a year since I was on retreat, but I had an interesting experience that I don't know, maybe other people that didn't have. It was a 5-day retreat, and everybody says on the 5-day retreat you spend the first 4 days fighting with the retreat, and then you finally have your retreat on the 5th day, which generally was true for me. Finally started to kind of calm down on the 4th day, but then there was a minor incident for me, which is at lunch. I had a cookie, but I didn't realize it had walnuts in it, and I'm allergic to walnuts. So I had to leave the retreat, drive down the hill. It was an applicator, drive down the hill and find a place to buy some Benadryl so I don't react to it. But what was interesting was how alien everything was. As I was going to a CVS pharmacy and looking at a Starbucks and pulling out money and standing in line to pay for something, it just was like completely foreign to me in that moment and in that time frame. People were talking to me, and I had absolutely no idea what they were trying to tell me because it was, there was no context in my mind to really have a conversation. It was just really interesting. And then I went back to the retreat, and everything fell back in place again, which is good, but it was just very, very interesting.
Thank you. So, every night of this retreat, at 9 o'clock, which is what it is right now, we would start our final sitting of the night by chanting the Metta Sutta. So we're going to do that. And I'm sorry I didn't make copies for everybody, but I know many of you have it memorized. We'll just do the verbal. Don't want to try to chant. We'll just do the verbal version of it. How many people know this? You got yours? You get a copy here if somebody wants it. Also, if you don't have a copy and you don't know it, just feel the meaning behind the words as we close with this. I think we'll just read it. Yeah. Just do it as a poem. So this is the Karaniya Metta Sutta, the Discourse on Loving Kindness. Feel free to join in if you do want. This is what should be done by one who is skilled. gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm, and wise and skillful, not proud and demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, let all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings, radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, free from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being free from all sense desires, is not born again into this world.
So would you do a favor for me and help us share the merit?
Close your eyes. Take a deep breath. Blow it out. May the merits of our practice together this evening, the metta that we've shared, reach everyone in this room, out to everyone in this property, human and animal and insect, the air we breathe, the trees that give us the air that we breathe. May this evening be one that holds our heart in a very special way, knowing that the time we spent together was so very important for this moment in time and the ripple